seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Fisk Electric versus Constructors and Associates, Inc. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument and appreciate the counsel's readiness and willingness to be able to proceed at this time.
May it please the court, Mr. William Biden.
May it please the court. The issue presented in this case is as follows. When the underlying tort suit alleges only negligence by the indemnity, does this court's decision in Ethel versus Daniel Construction create a rule of contract construction for indemnity clauses that first applies as a matter of law before negligence is determined by a fact finder, and second, bars indemnity for defense costs when the governing indemnity provision fails the express negligence test? Fisk would submit to this court that the answer to this question is yes, under a faithful reading of Ethel versus Daniel Construction. In answering this question, we would ask the court to focus on a couple of key facts. First, the underlying tort plaintiff, Mr. Devine, sued Constructors only for negligence. Second, Constructors stipulates that the clause at issue here does not satisfy the express negligence test. It could hardly contend otherwise. The clause in the contract that would have satisfied the express negligence test was expressly crossed out, deleted during the negotiation process. And bear in mind, this is Constructors' form contract, not Fisk's. During the negotiation process, the parties explicitly agreed to delete that portion of the clause that would have satisfied the test, thereby indicating an intent that Constructors would not be indemnified for claims stemming from its own alleged negligence.
Of course, there's no finding that whether or not they were negligent.
That is correct. There has been no finding, and in the summary judgment filed in the district court, Fisk did not even purport to try to establish that Constructors was negligent, because it is our position that this is an inquiry that is a question of law rather than a question of fact. And if I may point out one additional fact of significance, since the applications for writ were filed in this matter, it has now come to light that the underlying tort plaintiff, Mr. Devine, and Constructors have settled their claims. That means that unless this court requires a determination to be made as to negligence in order to interpret this clause, nobody is ever going to say whether or not Constructors acted negligently. And that's going to tie in later to the policy discussion that I'll get to in a moment.
Mr. Boyce, what have other states done on this question?
We have not undertaken to perform any kind of a survey state by state to determine that. We would be pleased to submit that in terms of supplemental briefing if the court so wishes. Under this court's decision in Ethel, we would submit that these facts mandate that there is no indemnification for attorney's fees in this matter. And that follows because Ethel instructs courts to interpret indemnity provisions from their four corners. Stated another way, the interpretation of an indemnity provision is a question of law. That comes from Justice Gonzalez's opinion, the opinion for the court in Dresser versus Page. Both components of fair notice, the express negligence doctrine and conspicuousness, are deemed to be questions of law. And they are deemed to be such in order to promote uniformity of interpretation so that parties can negotiate their contracts and interpret their contracts without having to fight it out in the courtroom.
Under this indemnity provision, would Fisk have been liable for any damages arising out of any transaction, event, or occurrence other than the negligence of contractors, employees?
In other words, other than its own negligence, other than Fisk's own negligence?
Yeah, other than Fisk's own negligence.
I suppose you could create a hypothetical where, let's say, a third party, not an employee of any of the parties involved, but just the third party happened to be standing near the switchgear when it exploded. They were injured. They filed suit against Constructors And let's say that they allege that Fisk was negligent and that Constructors is vicariously liable for whatever theory they choose. That might be one circumstance where this indemnity clause would have application. But if you're talking about a situation
but
where...
And if they, if there was no liability, however, in that transaction, but just simply left over defense attorney's fees, attorney's fees on defending and costs, would those two likely be passed through this indemnity agreement?
If there is no allegation of negligence as against Constructors, the answer to your question is yes, those would be passed through.
Those
would have been consciously shifted. But, okay. I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up?
Well, then the next question, I guess the follow-up then is this. If all types of business transactions with this indemnity agreement can be passed through, so long as what's being passed through is not the result of the negligence of Fisk, I guess, then why aren't attorney's fees out of all these transactions passed along, even though one of the claims or the claim that was originally filed might have been based on negligence?
Well, I think...
I mean, what necessarily about this... This provision is a general indemnity agreement.
Correct.
The argument is that because it does not expressly include negligence, it doesn't pass through damages flowing from negligence. But negligence is just a small part of an otherwise general indemnity agreement. What is it about the rationale of if I don't have negligence in there, I also am automatically excluding attorney's fees and costs from being considered in a general indemnity agreement? I guess
I'm not sure it goes that broadly, and one the short answer to your question is on the facts of this case where only negligence is asserted against Constructors, the indemnification for fees has to follow indemnification for liability, and that is under the policy enunciated in Ethel. I think what is inherent in your question is a point that several of the courts of appeals have raised in discussing express negligence. The argument goes like this. If there's no finding of negligence, then how is Ethel implicated? The idea being a narrow reading of Ethel that says that the only policy concern being addressed there was a reluctance to allow one party to shift the consequences of their negligence to someone else. I would submit to the court that that line of reasoning misapprehends what was going on in Ethel, because the real policy issue is fair notice.
I'm sorry, I must not say my question. The indemnity agreement says, to the fullest extent permitted by law, Fisk shall indemnify, hold harmless, and defend Constructors from and against all claims, damages, losses, expenses, including but not limited to attorney's fees.
Correct.
That's a pretty general indemnity agreement.
Correct.
Now, what Ethel says is, unless within that agreement you say this also includes negligence, claims that are based on negligence,
correct,
then this doesn't mean you transfer the responsibility for damages arising out of negligence. That's what Ethel says. My question is, forget about negligence. You're not trying to pass through any damages for negligence. What's happening here is now, are attorney's fees not excluded from the all claims if the predicate for the attorney's fees was because you had been sued for negligence? What about Ethel means that has to be the result?
That has to be the result, Your Honor, under the fair notice rationale of Ethel. And this goes back to the point that the focus is not on whether negligence is shifted, but rather if negligence and the consequences of a negligence claim are shifted, but instead whether the parties have made a conscious decision, whether they are actually aware that that is being shifted. And I would stress the point of the word consequences, which is used in the Ethel decision itself. It's not just a question of shifting liability for a potential negligence judgment somewhere down the line. The case spoke in terms of the consequences, and one of the consequences of being sued for negligence is certainly the possibility of being held liable in a judgment, but also the attorney's fees that go along with defending against a claim of negligence. if you focus on the fair notice policy at issue here, it says this. If you have a claim, as here, for negligence, we are not going to allow you to shift any portion of the risk involved with a negligence claim, whether that be liability on the merits, whether it be fees, unless you use the magic words. We've told you what the magic word is. You've got to use the word negligence. It's not in this contract. It was explicitly stricken from this contract. And we say in no circumstances, indemnification for fees follows indemnification for liability. Otherwise, the bright line rule is not a bright line rule anymore. If defense fees are carved out for separate treatment, if the resolution of the meaning of an indemnity clause is made to turn on the resolution of a fact issue as to negligence, then there's no more bright line rule because you cannot interpret the indemnity clause from its four corners. You cannot interpret it as a matter of law, as was pointed out in Dresser versus Page. You've made it the determination of the meaning of this clause now turns on the resolution of a fact issue. And once you do that, whether you do it for liability, whether you do it for attorney's fees, the bright line rule and the policy that prompted the court to establish a bright line rule have been compromised. And the result is the satellite litigation, the plethora of lawsuits that bring us here to the court this morning, so that every employee versus contractor lawsuit will automatically spawn its own satellite lawsuit over the meaning of an indemnity clause to determine whether this one is covered. If the resolution of that is postponed until a finding as to fact, it no longer is a bright line rule. And that comes back to what the court was trying to accomplish in Ethel. If there was any doubt that this is a question of law, as established in Ethel, that doubt was laid to rest in Dresser versus Page. And once you get to the idea that interpretation of an indemnity clause to see if it satisfies the express negligence doctrine is a question of law, you get to the point that if it's a question of law, it's appropriate for resolution by way of summary judgment. And that's what the First Court of Appeals did in Monsanto, and that is the correct approach to resolving this dilemma. It's also what the Texas Supreme Court did in Gulf Coast Masonry. Without carving out defense costs for separate treatment, without waiting for a finding as to whether or not the indemnity was negligent, the court interpreted that clause and said it doesn't pass muster, rejected. We submit that indemnity for fees and indemnity for liability should be interpreted as a whole. It should be interpreted as a matter of law, and they are appropriate for resolution by way of summary judgment. This is the same idea that says indemnification is a right that needs to be earned at the bargaining table and not in the courtroom. It is easier for parties to require parties to expressly state what they wish to be indemnified for in their contract than it is to require them to spend 2 years after a tort incident arises litigating over the effective scope of their indemnity clause. If there is any doubt as to whether proof of negligence is required, we would submit that this was put to rest when the Ethel opinion said, we reject the reasoning of the Fifth Circuit's decision in Barnes. There's reasoning that's been put forth by constructors and some of the courts of appeals in this area that says, Ethel changed the test, but it didn't change the procedure. We've gone from clear and unequivocal, now we're at express negligence, but the prior procedure, requirement of proving negligence to determine the scope of the clause has not changed. This would submit to the court that Ethel's rejection of Barnes is a rejection of that prior procedure, and it is consistent with the notion that this is now a question of law for resolution by the court at the outset of litigation. Barnes has been rejected, and with it has been rejected cases of a similar vein, Copeland Well, Sierra and Payne. Those pre-Ethel cases do not survive because, again, it is a question of law. And if it's not a question of law, it raises sticky questions that arise when there is a settlement, as has now developed in this case. If there's a settlement, there's not going to be any determination as to negligence prior to the resolution of the indemnity question. If a party can, by the means of settling a case, take it outside the four corners rule, take it outside the question of law rule, we'd submit to the court that that seriously erodes the fair notice policy goals that were being promoted in this court's decision in Ethel. And if there are no further questions at this time, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Gina Fulkerson will present argument from respondent.
Ms. Fulkerson, very quickly, do you concede, I mean, has the underlying litigation settled?
Yes, Your Honor, it has. There are still some, there is still a part of that litigation which is ongoing. I.A. Naaman, who was the electrical design consultant on the job, has not settled, and there is not yet a final take-nothing or other judgment in that case due to a few remaining issues. But there has been a settlement and relief money paid in that case. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Gina Fulkerson, and I represent Constructors and Associates. I think you know the background, but Constructors and Associates was the general contractor on the work that was being done at One Shell Plaza. The work that was being done there that was at issue in this case was an electrical upgrade of that building. Fisk Electric Company was the electrical subcontractor that was hired to come in and do the electrical work. The men that were the plaintiffs in the underlying action were working in the basement of the One Shell Plaza building when an electrical switchgear cabinet, there was an explosion in that cabinet. They were injured and they filed suit against Constructors, who was a general contractor, Hines and some other defendants who were the building managers and owners, and then they also sued I.A. Naaman, who was the electrical engineer on the job. Fisk was not a direct defendant in that action, presumably because they were the employer of the injured party and they were barred by the workers' comp doctrine. The workers' comp bar would not, however, bar contract actions, and therefore Constructors filed a third-party action for indemnity against Fisk. Fisk then filed a motion for summary judgment in the underlying action, and that decision was made in that court that the underlying clause, the clause in the contract, the subcontract between Fisk and Constructors did not meet the Ethel doctrine, did not meet the express negligence doctrine. And in that procedure, in the summary judgment hearing, the argument was made by Constructors that, Your Honor, even if this provision does not meet the express negligence doctrine, consider the instance where Constructors would take this through trial or in a severed action, have pleadings and proof that they were not negligent. If they are not negligent, the express negligence doctrine does not apply, and therefore they ought to at the very least, recover attorney's fees and expenses and costs, because that's what the contract provision says. The trial court did not agree with that argument and said they were going to side with the Monsanto opinion as opposed to the other opinions that we've cited in our brief, including the opinions of R.L. Jones, Company versus City of San Antonio, out of San Antonio in 1991, R.B. Tractors, Inc. versus Mann, out of San Antonio in 1990, Champlin Petroleum Company versus Goldstein Corporation, out of Corpus Christi, 1990, Construction Investments and Consultants, Inc. versus Dresser Industries, Inc., out of the First District in Houston in 1989, and Continental Steel versus H.A. Lott, Inc. out of Dallas in 1989, and then Kirby Forest Industry versus Dobbs out of Belmont in 1987. That then went to that case. The summary judgment was then appealed by Constructors, and the Court of Appeals reversed the ruling of the trial court level, and then petitioner in this case filed an application for writ and were before the court on the issue of whether or not in instances where there's not been a pleading or proof, or there's not been proof and there's not been a determination of negligence, does the express negligence doctrine apply to bar recovery of attorney's fees?
Ms. Folkson, let me ask you, taking the positions of the case out of Dallas and this particular CA opinion, could not a defendant here, such as Constructors, get sued under negligence cause of action, settle the case, and as a part of the settlement, the parties agree that there was no negligence on the part of the constructors. Constructors pay a sum of money and then claim that since there's no finding of negligence, that Fisk would be liable for anything they paid on that claim.
Your Honor, I would like to say that that would be an easy way for someone in my position to get to the end they wanted to get to, but in all fairness to the indemnitor, they would not have been a party to that litigation, and therefore I do not think that they would be bound by a determination of negligence. And that is one of the reasons, even when we severed this action, there was some discussion about the fact that if they were not a party, if they were not kept in the main action, this would have to be relitigated or could potentially need to be relitigated, and that would be open to question. I would submit to the court, however, that under the current doctrine that we have with the express negligence rule, if there is a valid indemnity clause and there is either a settlement, there is a settlement as opposed to a determination of negligence, there is still a separate lawsuit many times determining whether or not that underlying settlement was reasonable, whether or not there was really any liability that should have been paid, whether or not the amount of money which was paid based on the damages and the liability was reasonable. So we're not getting away from the situation that we already have when we have a settlement, other than the fact that you have an additional issue, that being if you even have an application of the doctrine to begin with. In this instance, we would submit that if the express negligence doctrine were not at issue, if it were a valid clause and we had settled, that Fisk would not just be turning around and paying us the full amount of our settlement, but they would still contest the reasonableness of that, and there would still be another lawsuit. So this doctrine, which I'm asking you to look at and to hold, that being that the express negligence doctrine does not apply when you have no finding of negligence, does not increase the amount of litigation or cause additional satellite lawsuits that would not likely already happen over the reasonableness of an underlying settlement when there is indemnity. Now, in this provision, and as to the policy reasons as to whether or not Ethel and the policy behind Ethel would in any way be undermined by the express negligence doctrine being inapplicable when there is no finding of negligence, I would submit to you to analyze and to think about what Ethel intended to do, what the policy reasons behind Ethel were. Those policy reasons are the same policy reasons which have been current and which have existed throughout history, throughout even before we had Ethel, before we changed from the clear and equivocal to the express negligence rule, and that is that we don't want to, without having very clearly stated that in the contract, we don't want to encourage the shifting of risk, because whoever is negligent ought to be responsible for their own negligence, otherwise you don't have the deterrence value of lawsuits, et cetera. So you have a sort of a prejudice against indemnity provisions. That's what the petitioner has told you. But I would submit that in this instance, if the respondent in this case, the indemnity, has to go forward in a lawsuit where the negligence is at issue, and if there is a jury finding that there is no negligence, then they would not be shifting any burden. They would not be finding themselves in a situation where they had done a wrong and someone else was paying for it, because the whole premise is that if there is no negligence, then they ought to at least be able to take advantage of that part of the indemnity provision which requires the payment of attorney's fees. And I would submit, as the argument has been made, that under the provision that was written between Fisk and constructors, the argument has been made by petitioner that a part of that was stricken, that the language which otherwise would have satisfied the express negligence doctrine was taken out. And I'll agree with you that it was, and that's why I'm not here before this court trying to say that this clause meets the express negligence doctrine. What I'm arguing is that the parties did not strike the rest of the clause. If they were trying to do anything with the rest, they were trying to say you will not recover anything under any circumstances, no attorney's fees, nothing like that, they should have stricken the whole clause, but they did not. And so if you're looking at intent, if you're looking at fair notice, if you're looking at fairness between the parties, then I would ask you to think about the fact that there is an entire provision there that was not stricken, which should be given meaning. And that provision holds that there should be a full, to the fullest extent allowed by law, the contractual indemnity provision would require indemnification hold harm that fits indemnify, hold harmless, and defend constructors against all claims, damages, losses, and expenses, including but not limited to attorney's fees. And then it goes on to say arising out of work being done on the project and when there is bodily injury.
Ms. Ferguson, suppose if we adopt, if we go with the clerk Bill's opinion, and you have a general indemnity provision that does not expressly transfer the risk under negligence, and we say yes, but this provision does not exclude the payment of attorney's fees where there is not an improvement by negligence. Haven't we, in fact, said that this indemnity agreement means that the indemnitor must come and defend any negligent lawsuit? Because until after the fact, when we determine that there's no finding of negligence, either way, finding negligence or no negligence, the indemnitor is going to be responsible for those attorney's fees, so they're just going to have to defend them anyway.
Your Honor, I would think that they could wait, as has been the case in Champlin and others, or as in constructors, the two cases, the Construction Investment and Consultants, Inc. and Continental Steel. In both those cases, they simply waited until after there was either a settlement or a jury determination and agreed to be bound by those, and then they said, at that point, we will determine attorney's fees. Of course, if they want to have control over the attorney's fees and the amount and that sort of thing, they could come in ahead of time, but then they might be in a situation where they paid money and there was a finding of negligence and they really were not required to go in and provide a defense, because it doesn't say that. What we're arguing, what we're telling the court, is that we're not asking for attorney's fees and expenses in instances where there is negligence, where there is a finding of negligence, because under that type of a clause, the express negligence doctrine would apply. So I think that while they could go ahead and do that, they might be then paying out money that they were not actually required to pay if later there is a finding. And I think they could certainly be justified in waiting or litigating in a separate action or a separate action going forward as quickly as they could and making that determination.
But with your interpretation of how this should apply, when a negligence claim is made, the parties, irrespective of Ethel, cannot tell whether or not they're going to be responsible for attorney's fees.
Your Honor, I would submit that that would be true until there was a determination of negligence one way or the other. And that is often true as to when or if there will be a contractual provision that applies. We don't disagree that as to the interpretation of the meaning of the clause, it is a question of law. But as happens in many cases, you have a fact issue that determines whether or not that contractual provision, as it is interpreted by the court, applies or doesn't apply. For example, I'll give you an example that has come up in this case in a different instance. There is an indemnity clause in another contract with another party that outlines who will be indemnified. And one of the individuals to be indemnified is the architect. And in some instances, the architect is defined as including the electrical engineer, and in other instances, they're not. I would submit that it would be a fact question as to who is the architect. Whether or not as to what the contract says, but you have to determine if the architect is going to be indemnified, who is the architect and who is the electrical engineer and who is somebody else. So there is a fact issue. I mean, it's probably one that's very simply resolved because there's probably not a lot of dispute as to who the architect is, but there could be. There could have been more than one party at issue or maybe conflicting roles. And in that instance, you would have to have a jury determination as to who is entitled to claim the benefits of this contractual provision. There are other instances in other contracts that might not be as clear to analogize to, but certainly in other instances you have, for example, an employment contract that says, maybe a collective bargaining agreement or something that says all employees will be entitled to these rights. But the determination of whether or not somebody was an employee or an independent contractor or an employee at all, whether or not they were within the course and scope of the employment contract, will be a question of fact. So there are instances where questions of fact determine the applicability of a contractual clause. Then, of course, the meaning of that contractual clause is a legal issue. And in this instance, what we're saying is that a determination of fact, determination of whether there is negligence, would then be made by a jury, but then would in turn decide or give the court information upon which to rule whether or not this contractual provision is applicable. Because if there is negligence, then the express negligence doctrine applies. As has been consistently argued in the cases I've cited, including Construction Investments and Consultants, Inc., it simply does not make any sense to apply the express negligence doctrine. And all the policies behind the express negligence doctrine, if someone is not trying to recover for the consequences of its own negligence. And Ethel specifically provides that parties seeking to indemnify the indemnity from the consequences of its own negligence must express that intent in specific terms. We are not asking this court to uphold a situation where Constructors is asking anyone to indemnify them for their own negligence. We are only asking that the rest of the contractual provision, the rest of the indemnity clause, an independent clause, be given meaning. And that meaning is that if Constructors is not negligent, then they should be entitled to recover of their attorney fees and their expenses, and that the clause that would otherwise prohibit or invalidate that provision, the Ethel Doctrine, does not apply. Furthermore, I would just want to say that as a second part of this, there is the argument about the burden of proof. And the cases are very consistent that the indemnitor would have the burden of proving the negligence and that they would, in fact, have to prove the negligence before they could say that the express negligence doctrine applies to void out an otherwise valid contractual agreement. This is not done. And the argument that has been made in the brief that the petitioner has submitted was that that somehow puts Constructors at a disadvantage, that all the cases don't apply, that we never got a finding of negligence. And I would submit to this court that the motion for summary judgment was brought by Fisk in the underlying lawsuit before we ever even got a chance to get close to a jury finding. So we should not be penalized by the fact that the trial court submitted and granted a summary judgment before we could ever get to the jury determination of negligence stage. The petitioner has argued that in the case of Construction Investments and Consultants, Inc. and Continental Steel, that in those two cases there was already a jury determination of no negligence, and thus the court would not want to apply such a harsh ruling that would otherwise tell them that they couldn't recover their attorney fees. I would submit that it is even more harsh to say that Constructors should not be given its day in court on the jury issue, should not even be given a chance to have a jury determine whether there is negligence before the court says, you're out of court under no circumstances, regardless of whether a jury might have found negligence or might not have found negligence, you will never recover attorney fees. Your Honor, I would submit that this is a fairly straightforward and narrow argument, and I won't take up any additional time unless there are further questions. I would ask that this be the Constructor's situation and the actual application of the Ethel Doctrine will not undermine Ethel, and it will not, in fact, affect the Ethel test except for determining when Ethel applies. And I said I was going to cut off, but I want to add one more thing, and that is that even before, and when we're looking at applicable cases, there is a Texas Supreme Court case which was decided under the clear and unequivocal doctrine. That was Sierra and Payne. That case is cited in our brief. In the Sierra and Payne case, what they said was that, again, you had to have a pleading and proof of negligence. And then the cases that have since looked back at Sierra and Payne, including Construction Investments and Consultants and Continental Steel and Champlin and many of the others, have looked at that Texas Supreme Court case and said, even though it was pre-Ethel, the test was different, but when the test was to be applied should remain the same. They wouldn't apply the clear and unequivocal test in a situation where there was no negligence, and we shouldn't apply the express negligence doctrine when there is no negligence. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Some brief rebuttal points. Lest there be any doubt, we do want to make it clear that FISC is not here advocating that Construction and Investment or Continental Steel correctly decided. We submit that the dissents in those cases properly analyzed the scope of the express negligence rule under the facts of those cases. But in the spirit of not biting off more than you have to in order to prevail, I would point out to the court that we are not presented with a situation where there has been a finding of no negligence. If the court chooses not to, it does not have to reach that issue. But if the court does so choose, we would submit that the dissent, and particularly Justice Lagarde's dissent in the Continental Steel, got it exactly right. Because if it is a question of law, and if it is divorced from any fact issue as to negligence, it doesn't matter whether there is a finding of negligence, a finding of no negligence, or no finding of negligence. It is a question of law determined from the four corners of the contract. That's the point. And it goes back to this idea of what is the policy that is being promoted here. Constructors tells the court that the policy is that the court does not want to encourage the shifting of risk. Not quite. Justice Hecht nailed it on the head during the argument in the HLMP versus Santa Fe case. The policy is not shifting risk when you're not focusing on it, when you're not aware that that is what's being done. And that goes back to the point that this is a right that needs to be set out explicitly, and it needs to be earned at the bargaining table. Justice Enoch's hypothetical raises an interesting issue. I think I heard Constructors' Counsel suggest that it wouldn't be fair for the settlement proceeds to be shifted on to the indemnitor in that circumstance. I would submit to the court that under the no finding of negligence approach to resolving these issues, that is exactly what would happen. That is what did happen in the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals case in Champlin, which is cited in the brief. That was a case where the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals rendered judgment against the indemnitor in a situation where the indemnity settled the underlying tort suit, rendered judgment not only for fees, but also for the amount of the settlement. Why? Because the settlement contained standard disclaimers, this is not evidence of negligence, no admission as to negligence is made, and because applying the rule that constructors would advocate for this court, the indemnitor did not plead and prove as a matter of law that the settling indemnity was negligent. I would submit to the court that that is a curious way to construe indemnity contracts according to their four corners. An even more extreme situation, if you follow the logic of where constructors' position takes you, is the Beaumont Court of Appeals decision in Kirby Forest. There is a case where the indemnity was found negligent. And in that circumstance, the Beaumont Court of Appeals said, well, normally, allowing contractual indemnity to be passed along in this way would violate the express negligence rule. But it wasn't pled and proven as an affirmative defense, and therefore it doesn't apply here. Again, if you take the logical extreme of where constructor's position takes you, Kirby, Forrest, Champlin, that's where you get to. That's the result where you get to. And I would submit to the court that that is a long way away from what Justice Wallace said in Ethel in terms of ending the satellite lawsuits, construing it as a matter of law. I would also draw the analogy to an insurance contract. I think this comes from Justice Lagarde's dissenting opinion in Continental Steel. And I think it's a helpful way to think about this. If you've got an insurance contract that excludes coverages for intentional torts, and the insured is sued alleging only an intentional tort, and the insured obtains a jury finding that no intentional tort occurred, can the insured in that circumstance still come back and say, okay, now pay my fees because it's been determined that I didn't commit an intentional tort? No. And why is that? Because that class of liability is not covered by that contract. And what the express negligence rule says is that unless you use the magic words, and we're telling you what they are, you've got to use the words negligence, that class of liability for fees, for judgment, for any component is not going to be covered. I think that takes care of the most important points I'd like to make on rebuttal. If there are no further questions, we'll conclude our remarks and ask this court to affirm the summary judgment entered by the district court in this matter.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments for the day. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs. All arguments and the marshal will now please adjourn.
The audience will be fired. Oh, yay. Oh, yay.